And we're back. Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. By the way, you go to Facebook/ The Taylor Report. We're available. And, of course, we're at Taylor-Report.com. And you can write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM. We're always glad to hear from people. We hope soon to be talking to Keith Bolander. I hate to complain about a horse race, but as far as I'm concerned, they call it the sport of kings, and I can see why they do that, because it seems to be ruled by kings, and there are no rules. And so they really foxed us at the Belmont. We'll do a whole program about it. But we are joined now, I believe, by Keith Bolander. You're there, Keith?
Yes, Phil, I'm here. How are you doing?
Doing very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Sorry, we're just a trifle late getting back to you. You have wonderful books. I want people to know the titles: Voices from the Other Side, An Oral History of Terrorism Against Cuba, and has a rather well-known author who introduced it, Noam Chomsky, in 2010. You also have the book Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution and Its People. And to begin with, the siege seems to be with us. It's not just some historical thing. We talk about it's been, you know, a long boycott, but recently there have been arrests made in Cuba of people, individuals from Miami, or Miami-based. Does that surprise you, and can you tell us what you know about it?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. This situation has been ongoing since the early months of the revolution. The incident you refer to, the Cuban government arrested four American residents the end of April, and charged them with planning to attack a military base and try to attempt some call for violence to create a situation in Cuba that would assist in the overthrow of the Cuban government, and these types of plans have been going on since the revolution triumphed in 1959. The Cuban government arrested the four of them and interviewed them. And since that, the information has come out that three of the four that were arrested admitted they were connected to another well-known terrorist in Miami, Santiago Alvarez. This person, Santiago, was arrested in 2005 for possession of a large cache of weapons aimed at carrying out attacks against Cuba.
Uh-huh.
Now, the interesting thing about Santiago Alvarez, he is directly connected with the most famous or infamous terrorist, Cuban-American terrorist, based in Miami, and that is Luis Posada Carriles.
Mm-hmm.
Who we may be familiar with. He was involved with the bombing of the Cubana Airlines in 1976. He was involved in the series of bombings against Cuban hotel and tourist facilities in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And Santiago Alvarez was connected with Luis Posada Carriles in the Posada Carriles' illegal entry back in the United States in 2005. So these four Cuban Americans that were arrested by the Cuban government at the end of April have connections right up to Luis Posada Carriles. And this is what the Cuban government has always said. They have to be so vigilant against these attempted acts of terrorism that continue to this day, and plays such a large role in the concept of the Cuban government being under siege, not only from these acts of terrorism, but all the other aspects of American aggression against Cuba, and it connects with the Cuban government's national policies, surveillance programs, all to protect itself and its citizens, and they get criticized considerably for that in the international press for restricting civil rights. But the Cuban perspective is we have to protect ourselves and our citizens against these types of terrorist acts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has always been. With the George Bush Jr., I guess you'd call him, he officially gave us this war, Which he said initially when the U.S. Was reacting to the acts of terror in New York and Washington, they said there should be an international war against terror. And Cuba agreed. And matter of fact, the Cubans made, they had a large demonstration, if memory serves, in sympathy with the victims of the 9/11. And yet U.S. Treats them, puts them, creates a list of countries that are not, you know, okay, the bad guys, and Cuba's on that list. Can you talk about how that could be?
It's really the height of hypocrisy, and the Cuban government gets so upset with this situation. The American government always includes Cuba on the list of states that sponsor terrorism. They've been on it since the early 1980s, and the Cuban government objects to that so strongly because it's the Cuban side that have been victimized by these hundreds of acts of terrorism, mostly conducted by anti-revolutionary Cuban-American organizations based in South Florida. There's been over 3,000 Cuban civilians killed from these acts. Mm-hmm. So when America declared its war against terrorism, it's all perspective because the Cubans have been fighting a war against terrorism for more than 50 years, but the mm-hmm. terrorism that has been committed against their civilians just doesn't count.
Yeah, by the way, it's interesting that so many people, commentators, have said, you know, the U.S. is so presumptuous in the way it deals with these matters because they themselves would be far more susceptible to the charge of sponsoring terror, and yet they actually presume to have a list and as you point out in an article in The Guardian some time back, it's an entirely arbitrary list. You can get on the list or off it depending upon your relationship to the U.S. government. Right? I mean, I'm thinking there's a group, for example, based in Iraq, which everybody agreed was terrorist. It was against the government in Tehran. But the U.S. then just one day decided to take it off the list.
Well, when Cuba was put on the list, I believe it was 1982, they took Iraq off the list. Because at that
they point, had an opening.
Yeah, at that point, Iraq was considered the good guys, and I guess they had to fill it with someone, and it was so convenient to fill it with Cuba, and it's strictly political, and the unfortunate thing is it does have meaning because if you're on that list by American law, those countries are subject to certain economic punishments, and the Cubans have been suffering from that ever since. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a list that has no meaning. There are economic consequences that the American government imposes on these countries, but it's just so hypocritical because there's been so much terrorism committed against Cuban civilians by Cuban Americans, and in the early 60s, supported by the American government. But that whole history is completely ignored, and that was the main reason why I wrote the first book. When George Bush Jr.'s war on terrorism was the most important international topic, the Cubans were sort of waving their hands and say, hey, what about us?
Well, yes. By the way, the title again of that is Voices from the Other Side, An Oral History of Terrorism Against Cuba. And, of course, this is Keith Bolander. He has a new book, Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. Keith, now you've been, you are called upon to speak in many quarters because of your expertise in these matters. I understand you were speaking on the issue of the Cuban Five, and you were, I think, visiting a couple of cities in the U.S. Can you tell us what's the atmosphere around the subject of the Cuban Five, and maybe tell us a little about those events?
Yeah, I was in Washington last week for the third annual conference for the Cuban Five, and the Cuban Five are a group of Cuban intelligence agents who infiltrated Cuban-American organizations that were conducting a lot of these acts of terrorism, and the agents were discovered, arrested, and were sentenced to long prison terms by the American government basically for trying to prevent acts of terrorism. So there's a huge international campaign to free the group known as the Cuban Five. There are two released already. There's three left in prison, one serving a double life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And the conference took place last week in Washington, attracted hundreds and hundreds of participants. I was fortunate enough to be asked to speak on the history of terrorism against Cuba. There was a huge rally in front of the White House on Sunday, and there's been meetings with a certain number of congressmen in Washington who know about the case, which is a great accomplishment, and are sympathetic. So there's tremendous activity in regards to trying to free the Cuban Five, and it just keeps growing and growing.
Mm-hmm. I assume you, everyone addresses, I hope, this issue. For example, we have the report of the situation where four people have been arrested, have been identified, and there's been discussion already of what their ties are to Miami. Now, this is clearly in violation of U.S. law, isn't it? I mean, can there be any debate about that, that people training and mounting attacks on Cuba? Shouldn't the federal marshal be down there closing them up?
Well, that's what the Cuban government keeps asking, and they've been asking it for many years.
Do you have any laws, sir?
Yeah, there's the violations of the Neutrality Act. There are certain legal actions that the American government could take against these activities.
Well, by the way, Lord knows that in the case of American Muslims of all nationalities, there's been all kinds of surveillance of them and people being taken off the streets by a very vigilant government and claiming it's concerned about terror.
Well, absolutely, and there's two issues here. I mean, the Cuban connection just doesn't create the same amount of attention. People just don't know what's happening or what has happened in regards to acts of terrorism against Cuban civilians. The American media rarely, if ever, reports on it. And when these acts started in the early 60s, they were portrayed as being freedom fighters against the Cuban revolution and the communist government. Mm-hmm. Well, things changed after 9/11. There's no such thing as a freedom fighter. You're a terrorist or you're a terrorist. But it still gets back to which side you're on. If it happens to our side, it's a different reaction to if then it happens to the other side. And Cuba is the other side. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely difficult to get any attention. It's extremely difficult to prosecute. And the Cuban government is understandably a little gun-shy, because the case of the Cuban Five deals directly with this situation. The Cuban government had a tremendous amount of information on these Cuban-American organizations. They had information about future acts of terrorism that these groups were planning based on the infiltration by the Cuban Five intelligence agents. Well, the American government took that information and promptly uncovered the agents and arrested them. So the Cuban government's a little gun-shy about this whole situation.
Well, one understands. But, you know, it is interesting. If someone comes to you and says, well, I have information these guys are going to commit a crime, well, if you think maybe the person informing you of that is himself guilty of something, that doesn't have anything to do with the prosecution of the ones who are going to commit the crime.
Exactly.
It would only be reasonable if you arrested all of them and said, you shouldn't be doing this, and of course I'm not going to let him do that.
But when it comes to Cuba, there's a whole different set of rules. I mean, the American government still hasn't forgiven the Cuban Revolution, and any opportunity to punish it, they'll use it. So, you know, in any other situation, the rational reaction would be to, well, we don't arrest the agents that presented this information, we arrest the terrorists. But when it comes to Cuba, it often is the exact opposite of what people think should be rational.
Yeah, and they really reached the scandalous point where they actually aided and abetted Mr. Kareli's entry into the United States.
And
helped him actually, he escaped charges in Venezuela.
Posada Kareli,
another country that they don't approve of.
Posada Carreras came back into the United States illegally in 2005 with the assistance of this Santiago Alvarez person who's connected with the four that the Cubans just arrested. But when Luis Posada Carreras came back into the United States illegally, he was only charged for illegal entrance into the United States. He's never, ever been charged with any acts of terrorism, even though he admitted his involvement, particularly in the bombing campaign against hotels in Havana in 1997. There was a series of New York Times articles where he...
Yeah, they had the tapes of the yep. of the interviews.
And a Canadian Italian businessman, Fabio DeSelmo, was killed during one of these bombings. Mm-hmm. And so you have Luis Posada Carreras, who's been identified as, you know, one of the worst terrorists in the Western Hemisphere by the State Department, living peacefully in Miami. So mm-hmm. so the Cuban government, understandably, is a little hesitant to take any promises that the U.S. side has made to move against these terrorists.
Yes. Well, he wasn't even particularly inconvenienced, right, in his movements. I recall him being held briefly, if that, and then he went back to Florida, right?
Well, yeah. The trial took place in El Paso, Texas, and in 2002, I believe, 11, and I was there, partly covering it and partly in support of the Cuban Five. And the trial was very short. He was given a slap on the wrist. Told don't enter into the United States illegally anymore, and said okay, thank you very much. And now they let him go back to his house in Miami. He's been living there peacefully ever since.
Well, by the way, it does raise the issue that you said a Canadian citizen, Italian Canadian, was killed there, and they didn't. No message came from Ottawa saying hold that individual because we have a matter we want to talk to him about, which would happen almost every other venue, right?
Yeah, that's a very good point. The Canadian government never asked or complained to the U.S. Side about this terrorist who killed a Canadian regarding that. But there's been in the early and mid '60s, including at Expo 67, there were Cuban American bombings against targets in Montreal, Ottawa, and Toronto, and the Canadian government made very little protest, even though they knew who was involved and which organizations were involved.
Ideology in politics is kind of important. We're speaking to Keith Bollinger, and who's the author of two very, very important books, Voices from the Other Side, An Oral History of Terrorism Against Cuba. And Noam Chomsky, I believe, provided an introduction to that. And Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution and Its People, and published in 2012. There is a lot of, across the hemisphere, our hemisphere, there's a lot of sympathy for Cuba, the governments that don't share the same ideology, but certainly some of the concerns. Is that, how do you gauge how helpful, is it climate improving on this issue of fighting terrorism and respecting Cuba?
Well, Cuba's position within Latin America is the best it's ever been. They have relations with all countries in Latin America, whether they're left, center, or right, politically influenced. The only country that's isolated in its relationship with Cuba is the United States. And the conference, the Cuban Five conference in Washington last week, demonstrated just how much international solidarity there is. There's diplomats, officials, supporters from around the world. There's mm-hmm. been dozens of Nobel laureates. There's international activists, parliamentarians from Europe, from South America, from all over the world in support of releasing the five because it is such an injustice. And, you know, Cuba does certainly appreciate the international support. And the Americans just basically shrug it off. And a large part of that is there's so few people in the United States know of this case.
Yep.
If there was more information out there, these conferences really helped that. But if there was more Americans who knew of this case and how unjust it is, then you'd have much greater pressure on the American government to resolve it.
Yeah, if they took the war against terrorism seriously, then they would be for freeing them and also putting an end to using terror against other people. Well, Keith Bollender, you've written a couple of tremendous books, and I hope everybody gets some Voices from the Other Side and Cuba Under Siege. I'm sure glad you were speaking in the U.S. I'll bet it everybody benefited, and thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Phil, for having me.
Okie doke. Keith Bollender, thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Of course, we are Facebook/ The Taylor Report and Taylor-Report. Boy, I'm going to get tired listing all the links. Next thing we're going to do is Twitter. Phil, you were going to say something. This is Phil Conlon.
Well,
who has a Wednesday program? 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
Classical Underground.
Classical Underground. And this week we have Professor Eric Domvill on. He's a professor emeritus of English at U of T. And we're going to talk about the composer Richard Strauss on the occasion of his 150th birthday. Well, what would be if he was still with us, but of course he hasn't been in a long time.
Well, no, listen, everybody celebrates, you know, Lincoln, Washington, Mackenzie King. We all get excited about these things. Well, I better clarify what I was saying about the California Chrome. The Sport of Kings, which my interpretation of that is that they created this expression Triple Crown, but it turns out that each race has its own rules, and you can enter a horse in the Belmont Stakes, that's the third of the Triple Crown, and not in the other two. So in other words, he rests while the other horse runs, then he knocks off the horse. And I agree with the owner. We had a blue-collar owner. We have class struggle in the race world. And he said, you guys are cowards. He said, if you want to win, you want to participate in a Triple Crown, you have to participate in all three races. That way we know if you're the real thing. But he says, laying in the grass like that and waiting, putting a target on my horse, that's not fair. See, he's not such a bad guy.
Well, how well did his horse do?
Fourth.
Fourth.
But he wasn't off the pace, but it was just too much. Yeah. And the other horse hadn't been running. But there's a nice, I want to congratulate them on their choice. You know, all these ruling class people, they have their horses with them. They call them their colors. They put on the horse little symbols. And theirs is DAP. Everybody said, gee, DAP, what does that stand for? And it stands for Dumbass Partners, because these are guys, they paid $8,000 for the mare and $10,000 for the stud, and they ended up with $1 million horse. And I'm sure they won't be invited back. At least we're sticking up for working class horses. This is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and we hope to see you next week.